to see everyone this morning. Thankful to be able to be out. We are very aware of the number of the congregation here who is struggling with health or fighting the virus that's going around, others who have family members who are terribly ill and maybe even taking care of them. I wanted to mention to you, Kirk just told me as he came in that he heard from John and Becky Trout, and her father has had another terrible stroke, and they don't think that he's going to make it this time. So they have headed that way to try to be there with him before something happens. But please keep them in your prayers and in their, I'm sure their grief, but also in their travel, that they'll be safe and just to be with their spirit to uphold them. So much difficulty like that going on right now, and we're thankful to the Lord for all of his goodness and all of his blessings, but certainly life on this earth is full of sorrow, and we need to be remembering one another in prayer. I remember vividly still, as a very young boy, and I don't know how old I was, but I was very, very young. My parents, on very special occasions, would take us to the drive-in theater because it was cheaper to go to the drive-in than it was to a walk-in theater. And we would take that station wagon to the drive-in and have a pallet made in the back because we'd usually fall asleep, that is, those of us kids. And I remember going to see one of the great John Wayne movies. If one came out, we tried to go see it. But it was one of the last ones, that one of the later westerns that he made, and it was entitled John Wayne and the Cowboys. And I was so excited to see that movie, and no one that I knew had seen it, no one had ruined it for us. I was devastated when John Wayne was killed in that movie. And I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember that movie, but that's the first time I'd ever seen the hero. You know, you always go into a movie with the hero of the movie, you know, a little bit worried about what's going to happen to him or to her, but then you have to remind yourself, well, I know they're not going to get killed. And I have never liked Bruce Dern since then. he was the actor that killed John Wayne in that movie. And I bring that up because I think that for all of us, we've had an occasion where someone that we looked up to, and of course this was a very innocent situation because it wasn't real, it was a movie, but it affected me nonetheless. It was a realization that a hero could actually be defeated, that someone that was great, the good guy, could lose, and I didn't like that. And of course, movies have been written more and more like that since then, but it shook me as a very young boy. And I have thought about that many times. You know, I think about in the life of David, in 1 Samuel chapter 17, he comes on the scene as a young, very young man, still a teenager, and he defeats the enemy of Israel, the enemy of God. He conquers Goliath. And in chapter 18, the people saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Here's a young man that is just surging to the top. He is the hero of the people. He's leading Saul's army at one point and going out and slaying the Philistines and those that want to desecrate the name of God. He was a hero of the people. And he eventually became king. Saul was deposed as king. God had prophesied that. He was killed in battle, and David came to the place of king. So as we get into 2 Samuel, after Saul has died, and Jonathan, Saul's sons, and David takes over as king, we come to that very sad time in 2 Samuel in chapter 11. When David is caught up in sin with Bathsheba, and not only in sexual sin, but he has her husband murdered. And in chapter 12, the Bible tells us that the Lord sent Nathan to David. And we know the event where Nathan goes to David and speaks to him about his sin. And when David becomes convicted of something that is clearly wrong, Nathan says to him in verse 7, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord, God of Israel, I appointed you king over Israel. I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping, gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I also would have given you much more. Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You've killed Uriah the Hittite with a sword, and you've taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon." In verse 14, God said to David, "By this deed you've given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme." I think that this stands out to me and probably to all of us because we grow accustomed to people in the Bible doing some terrible things, but we're not so accustomed to the heroes of faith doing something quite like what David did. Abraham lied on a couple of occasions. Moses seemed to stumble and to struggle and obviously stumbled there at the rock when he struck it twice instead of speaking to it. Aaron, Miriam, we have people in the Bible that they certainly lost their way. They made some mistakes. But what David did is one of those things that you stop and you have to gather your mind and think, did that just happen? And how did that just happen? How could a guy who has had faith like this do something like this? And invariably, I think at least at some point, it makes us question some things. You know, the disciples of Jesus ask him in Matthew chapter 19 and about verse 25, "Lord, who then can be saved?" You ever had that thought when you've read this account of David? Who then can be saved? David's not the only one. As I said, we see the mistakes of Noah got drunk, Abraham lied. We see the sin of Moses and Aaron and Miriam, as I said before. But it's not just that. We see the demise of Saul. He was a great man. We need to never forget who Saul was as a king, and then to see the absolute and utter demise in his life. And God takes that kingdom away from him. Peter, what a great disciple, follower of Christ, and yet he denied him three times. Not only that, but according to Galatians chapter 2, he played the hypocrite even after the gospel had been preached to the Gentiles. Over and over again, we see occasions where the mighty have fallen, where those who have been great men or women of faith have lost their way, and more than just a minor transgression, there's been a serious, serious disappointment. And for those who've looked up to these, it's difficult. I think about all the young boys and girls in Israel, how they must have had to struggle to cope with what David did. Around 2006, there was a time in my life when three people older than me in varying degrees, all three who had been great mentors of mine in the faith. As a matter of fact, for at least two of them, and in years when I had lost my way and was not faithful, very worldly, two of these men were so patient with me, encouraging, reaching out, trying to bring me back, and were successful. I can tell you to a very large degree the reason that I'm here serving the Lord today is on account of those two men, and a third, a gospel preacher that was a great mentor to me. In about 2006, by that year, in just a few short years, all three of those men fell away from the faith, late in life. All three wrecked their marriages and succumbed to sexual sin. It's something that I wouldn't have even imagined before in their lives. And as that happened to me, on into my preaching years, it was a tremendous lesson to me. It was a gut check, as we say. And I had to make some observations about what was happening to be able to make some sense out of that, and lest my own feet stumble. When people like that fall, how are we to cope with it? Well, I made some observations about that, and I'd like to share them with you this morning, because I doubt that there's anyone here who is really old enough to have been a Christian very long who hasn't had at least one occasion where they have been devastated by the fall of someone that they've looked up to tremendously. How do we deal with that? How do we cope? Well, I want to suggest to you that the Bible gives us several things that we need to learn, that we need to remember, that we need to realize when our heroes fall. And on many occasions, they will. The first thing that I want to suggest to you is that when our heroes fall, we need to realize that strong people sometimes fall. You know, that's the thing. We know there's characters in movies that, yeah, they're expendable. They'll probably get killed, you know. But not the hero, not this person. I think that's the way we kind of feel about some of those in the faith, people that we've looked up to. You know, I had come to be at least somewhat accustomed to the fact that some Christians would fall away, would hurt, would disappoint. But I wasn't quite ready for those three that stood out in my life. But I realize it now. And what it's helped me to do is first of all, not to take anyone for granted. To realize that I don't care where a person is in their life, whether they're serving as an elder or an evangelist or a deacon or they're a member who's been faithful throughout the years, don't ever take them for granted. If anything, Satan is working overtime on those people. He's putting everything before them that he can. You know, in Proverbs chapter 7, I find it interesting how the wise man states this when he's talking about the young man devoid of understanding, a young man who gave in to temptation with sexual sin, an immoral woman was able to deceive and to charm him. But I find it interesting that he says in verse 26, "For she cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men." All who were slain by her were strong men. You know, when we say that strong people sometimes fall, I'm giving his example of that at Moses. I look at what this man had accomplished. Don't tell me that he was weak in his faith. He was a man who was strong in many regards. And yet, look what happened to him in Numbers chapter 20. And I think that when we say that, it is difficult for us, because someone might say, well, then what hope do we have? You know, as we said before, you know, who then can be saved, as the disciples said to Jesus? Well, here's the key. Too many times, and I think what Satan is looking for, and it's a signal to him to really rush the line. When he begins to see that our perspective of our strength begins to change to where our strength, or at least our confidence in our strength, is in ourself instead of in the Lord. You know, in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, the Apostle Paul made an observation there in the same context in which he's telling us to each examine ourselves as to whether we're in the faith. But he was talking about his great struggle with that thorn in the flesh. And he said in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, he said in verse 10, "Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake, for when I am weak, then I am strong." So is Paul saying that it's better to be weak in the faith and not to grow spiritually? Well, I think we know that that's not the case. How do we understand this? What Paul was saying is that when we realize When we have an objective perspective of ourselves and we realize our own challenges, that's when we realize how much we need God. You know, the Pharisee and the tax collector in Luke chapter 18, I believe, the Pharisee was telling God, I'm glad I'm not like other men. I do this, I do this, I do this. And the tax collector said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Jesus said, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. And in verse 9, it tells us there in Luke 18 that he taught this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. That's what self-righteous really means. I know I've brought that out before. But to think that we are righteous in and of ourselves, we don't need the Lord's help, we don't need the sacrifice of Christ, and we are set for a fall every time we get to that point. And I've been there before. I've been there in my life where I've looked at what where I was with the Lord and where I was in my faith, and I was putting too much of my confidence in what I had accomplished. And usually, almost in every case, there's going to be a stumbling there. And every time it reminds me, don't ever put your confidence in what you're doing. That's not to say that there's not anything that we need to do. But what we're doing is we're cooperating with God. Our strength is in what God provides. It's in His word. It's in His people. It's in His grace. It's in His forgiveness. And we've got to never forget that. And so, yes, people that have shown strength in their faith sometimes fall. And that doesn't need to be a message to us that it doesn't do any good to study our Bibles, or it doesn't do any good to forsake sin and to pursue good things. It's not a signal to us that it doesn't matter how you live. Strong Christians are going to do this. People that aren't strong are going to do this, so might as well not try it. That is not the point. The point, though, is that sometimes people that we see as being strong, their strength is in their own works, and they are set for a fall. We've just got to realize that these things sometimes happen, and it doesn't need to challenge our faith. In 2 Samuel chapter 1, in verses 17 through 23, David is observing the death, the sad and tragic end of Saul and of Jonathan and of Saul's other sons. And David said on several occasions in that song that he sang in weeping, oh, how the mighty have fallen. The mighty fall. They do. And as I said, we look at what who Saul was and who Jonathan was, but they still fell. We've got to realize from this then, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 12, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. First of all, I need to realize strong people sometimes fall, and I need to be constantly assessing myself. Where is my strength? Is it in what I'm doing, or is it in the Lord? And then also, this needs to tell me not to discard their righteous example with their disappointing failure. The fact that David sinned doesn't mean that I've got to throw away everything good that he did. And we know that David came back to the Lord. What about Saul? Saul didn't come back to the Lord. But you know, we need to realize the same thing about Saul. As tragic as that was, there were some great things about Saul that we can learn from. We don't need to throw it all away. That doesn't mean that he was a phony his whole life. We need to be able to appreciate those things. And so when there's someone in our life, maybe it's a friend, like with me, or a family member, in my case, my brother Mark, who fell away. Or maybe it's a gospel preacher, who is another one of those three disappointed me. Whoever it is, we don't need to forget every good thing that they did. We need to take those, sift them out, appreciate the things that we can learn from them, and realize what was wrong. Strong men sometimes fall. And that leads us to the next point. And that is that we need to learn to never put our faith in men. I don't care how strong a person appears to be, we must never put our faith in men. Listen to the psalmist in the 146th Psalm and in verse 3. Do not put your trust in princes, nor in a son of man, in whom there is no help. His spirit departs, he returns to his earth. In that very day his plans perish. Do not put your trust in princes, nor in a son of man, in whom there is no help. So that doesn't mean that we can't learn from people in what they accomplish. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11 and in verse 1, imitate me even as I also imitate Christ. So yes, I can look to other people, men, women of the faith. Hebrews chapter 11 is telling us to do that. Look at these examples. They are giving testimony to the faithfulness of God, and look at their faith. We need to do that. But that's not the same as putting our trust in those people. You see that? We can see a great example, we can learn a lot of things, but we don't put our trust in those people. And this is the distinction. And I think for many of us, we fail to be able to make that distinction. I don't know what it is in man that we crave another man to follow, another human. I don't know what it is. It may be a part of the way that we're made. But I have to wonder if that's not why Jesus became flesh, dwelt among us. So many cases, Christians fall prey to that temptation to try to find someone they can look up to. And you know, for many of us, we are blessed with a dad that he's just bigger than life. In time, we're going to get old enough that we begin to see some of his failures. And then we have to cope with those. And we may go through a little time where we're a little disenchanted, but eventually then we come back and we have an objective view. We appreciate him for who he is. And he's still a hero, but he's still a man. And we realize he's not the same as Christ. And that's a good thing. We need to have people to look up to. That's what Paul was talking about. Imitate me to the degree that I imitate Christ. But sometimes we lose our way and we just keep being more and more and more impressed with this person. And they just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger than life. Let me tell you, that's exactly how cults begin. Cults are a result of someone who's a very skilled shyster that preys on people's desire to find a human to follow. And it doesn't take much to convince those people that this person is almost beyond human. It's easy to see that when it comes to David Koresh down in Waco, Texas, or someone like that. It's trying Jim Jones, back in the 70s. But we've got to be able to see it even when we're looking up to maybe a gospel preacher too much, becoming a preacher follower. Or maybe for our kids, we warn them about making athletes into their heroes. Or maybe it's some military leader or a leader of the country. People begin to see them as their hero. We've got to realize that there is not anyone, not any man, that we can successfully put our faith in. Jesus is the captain of our salvation, Hebrews 2 and in verse 10. He is our only leader that's going to give us that victory over Satan. And let me tell you something else that we've got to realize about this. In Malachi chapter 3 and in verse 6, God said, I am the Lord, I do not change. I can be confident that he's never, ever, ever going to waver. He's not going to be someone different. He's not going to succumb or give in to something that's evil. He's always going to be there, always righteous, always faithful. That's why I've got to put my faith in the Lord and not in men. So I need to be promoting Jesus and not some man, not some preacher, not some elder, not some ladies' Bible class teacher, not one of my parents, not some political figure. I need to be promoting Jesus, because everyone else will eventually disappoint. Our battle is for His exaltation. In Ephesians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul writes in Ephesians chapter 5 and in verse 1, "Therefore be imitators of God as dear children." That's who we need to be exalting. That's who we need to be looking up to in every way. And we need to let men serve as an example to the degree that they are imitators of Christ. That's what Paul was saying. But only to that degree. And to the degree that we see them not imitating Christ, to that degree, they should not be an example to us. They should not be held up as a hero to us. Now, there are going to be people that are unbelievers, people of the world that may do some great things, and we can appreciate those things to the degree that they are God's will. But one or two things in a person's life that is God's will is not enough to make a hero out of a person. And let us also remember that what makes a person great, you remember when Saul had his great fall and so tragic. But I want you to remember over in 1 Samuel, in chapter 15, the words that Samuel spoke to Saul. Samuel said to Saul in verse 17, "When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel?" I'm going to tell you what makes a person great. It's when they're little in their own eyes. Jesus said, when his disciples were arguing about who was going to be greatest in the kingdom, he said, "The greatest is the one who makes himself a servant." When you see someone who's not little in their own eyes, they shouldn't be anywhere close to a hero to you. There's very little to admire in that person. They may do some great things. We've seen some great generals in our country's history that did some great things, and we can appreciate that. But a hero? Those men are so lifted up in themselves, so prideful, so arrogant, and most of them found their demise as a result of that. We've got to remember who should be an example to us. No man should be our hero, only the Lord. And thirdly, when our heroes fall, we need to resolve not to let Satan overthrow more than that one person. I say this because sometimes it's easy for us to become so discouraged when we see someone fall, or we see the destruction of their faith. It's easy for us to grow so disappointed and discouraged that our own faith begins to waver. And a lot of times that's because we had too much faith in that person, and any faith we had in that person was faith we didn't have in the Lord. So sometimes the weakness in our own faith is exposed. But what we've got to quickly do is to realize this is not just about me and this person. The adversary is Satan. I've got to be able to see this as Satan won a victory. See the bigger picture. Satan won a victory. Now, what am I going to do? Am I going to give him another one? You know, when someone is maybe competing against you in some event, and they are so arrogant, they're so mean, they're so rude, and when they win, how do you feel about that? Would you like to see them win the next event? Oh, no. In most cases, we are very determined not to let them win again. And this is how we need to see an event like a failure in one's faith. When someone we've looked up to has fallen, instead of us just thinking, "What's the use?" we need to realize Satan did that in part to get me to fall. Satan's point in doing that is to try to destroy others. We need to realize that those who are looked to as leaders in the faith have the biggest target painted on them. Satan knows that if he can affect someone who is great in the eyes of other people, he will affect many. So what I've got to do is catch myself quickly and say, I am not. I'm angry. It needs to make me mad that Satan found a way to exploit this person's weakness. And as much as anything else in me is, I'm going to make sure he never does that to me. I will never let him have that victory. We need to have that kind of resolve, that kind of determination. You know, Paul said in Ephesians chapter 6, beginning in verse 10, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand." That needs to be our resolve. Not a hopelessness, but a resolve that I will not let him have another victory, not only with me, but I'm going to build up everyone that I love. I'm going to reach out to everyone I know. I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that he doesn't get one more victory. That'll make a difference. That's where we need to go. And to be sure that he's not going to have any of those victories. Hebrews 12 and in verse 3, he tells us to look to Jesus lest we become weary and discouraged in our souls. Number four, I want to suggest that when our heroes fall, we need to be sure to pray for and encourage the innocent who were injured by Satan's victory. And this is always going to happen. When we're talking about heroes, when we're talking about someone that other people look up to, it's devastating to a lot of people. A lot of innocent people are affected as a result of that. And we need to think about them. We need to do more than think about them. We need to be praying for them and thinking about how this may have impacted them. In Hebrews chapter 12, Paul said in I've got 14 through 15, but back up to verse 12. "Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord, looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled." We have a responsibility to be accountable for one another. And when we see this happen, one of the first things that we need to think about is, who is going to be impacted by this? We need to reach out to them. We need to be praying for them. We need to be seeking to encourage them. I don't think there's anyone here that has been a Christian very long that hasn't been injured by the destruction of someone's faith. In seeing someone that we've looked up to that has fallen away, that hasn't been hurt by something like that, we need to remember that feeling and how we need to reach out. And invariably, there are going to be those who are going to tell us, "I'm fine. I'm okay." I want to tell you that is, in most cases, a cover. It is some effort to cover that person's own frustration with their emotions, not knowing how to deal with all of that. Don't give up. Keep reaching out. If they won't let you, keep praying. Because this is a deep, deep hurt. And what happens is that it can have a lot of different effects on people. You know, if we're talking about, you know what, and I'm talking about people who've been a Christian long enough, it may be for some of the very young people here, that maybe there's another young person that they've looked up to who has fallen prey to Satan. And it's someone they never thought would. And it has deeply wounded them. I tell you, one of the things that can happen as a result of that is that innocent person can lose a certain measure of their innocence as a result of that. We need to realize what a great loss this is. They can begin to doubt their faith because, as I said, they may ask the question, as Jesus' disciples did, who then can be saved, Lord? And so that's why it is so important that we don't just sit back and wait for that person to ask. We need to be reaching out. We need to be talking to them. But above all, we need to be praying for them so that their faith would not fail. Yes, this is something that I think is maybe one of the most difficult things for us to do, is to think about people outside the one who has fallen, and to even get outside of ourselves and to look for those people. But also, when our heroes fall, we need to pray for the fallen one. If they are still lost in their sins, we need to reach out to them to bring about repentance, pleading for them to be touched. Sometimes they need to be rebuked sharply that they may be sound in the faith. Other times they need an arm around their shoulder to remind them that they can do this and that we'll be there with them. All of that depends upon the situation, depends upon the person. We have to assess where they are. What is their spirit? Are they just discouraged? Are they weak in their faith and need to be taught better? Or are they impenitent and arrogant? That's when they need to be rebuked sharply. But whatever the case, we need to reach out to them. But we need to reach out and encourage the penitent heart. Again, going to 2 Corinthians, in chapter 2, I want you to notice in chapter 2 and in verse 6, the Apostle Paul is speaking about the one that he wrote about in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, the one who had his father's wife, who was involved in sexual immorality, and he told them to withdraw from that one. And as we get to the second letter of the Corinthians, we find out that one was restored. And Paul says about this man in verse 6 of 2 Corinthians 2, the punishment which was inflicted by the majority is sufficient for such a man, so that on the contrary, you ought rather to forgive and comfort him, lest perhaps such a one be swallowed up with too much sorrow. When a person has repented, there is no place for groveling. There's no place for us to want to take just a little bit more time to get our pound of flesh, to try to get that person to know how bad they hurt us. When that person has repented, it is time to make sure that that person is not swallowed up with too much sorrow. If there's been enough godly sorrow that produces repentance, that's what he's going to talk about in chapter 7 of 2 Corinthians. Godly sorrow produces repentance, chapter 7 and verse 10 of 2 Corinthians. When there's been enough sorrow that repentance has taken place, an acknowledgement of that sin, a turning away from that sin, that's enough sorrow. There can be too much sorrow. We may be feeling a lot of sorrow, and we may want to put some of that sorrow on that person. And this is a verse that says, Brett, don't do that. When your hero has fallen, you might be angry with that person. You might be really angry. Well, let me tell you, anger is a part of grief. And when a hero has fallen, we're going to go through those stages of grief where there is shock and where there is sadness, and there's going to be a period of anger too. And whether a person has died physically or a person has died spiritually, all of that is a healthy part of grief. And if we try to take any of that away from a person, we're not helping them. We need to let people go through these stages of grief. However, be angry and do not sin. Does that make sense? We can be angry about a person who we love has died without sinning. That's a healthy thing. We need to go through that. And we need to be angry when a person has fallen away from the Lord. I was just talking about that. We need to be angry at Satan. We can be angry at the sin this person has committed. When I see a person who has committed sin and left their lifelong mate, left their children, I'm angry about the hurt in those innocent people, especially the children. I'm angry about that. I don't believe that's wrong. But I don't need to take that anger out on that person who sinned. So let's not think that we can't be angry or that people shouldn't be angry over the sin that has occurred. But we need to make sure that we go through those stages, that we center and focus our anger in the right place, at sin in general, at Satan, our adversary, anger over the hurt and the harm that's been caused. But when that sinner has repented, we need to do everything we can to restore and to encourage and to reaffirm our love for that person. This is the balance. And when we lose balance in either one of these areas, we are participating in the destruction of that person who's fallen. We need to be able to see it objectively. Reach out to them. Pray for them. You know, in 1 Samuel 15 and verse 35, after Saul had kept back some of the provisions and not obeyed God's will concerning the Amalekites, and Samuel told Saul, he said, this is it. You know, Saul had unlawfully offered that sacrifice, and Samuel said, God's chosen a man after his own heart to lead this nation. But then after that happened with Amalek, Samuel said, it's over. Samuel didn't see Saul again. And the Bible tells us in verse 35 that Samuel went home and he wept. He wept. Yes, we need to go through all these stages of grief, but we need to have enough love for this person that we are grieved over that sin. We need to care about them, and we need to make sure that we're doing everything that we can to help them be right with God. Examine ourselves in doing that as well. We also need to pray for one another. When one of our heroes has fallen, there are the innocent that have been deeply injured. There is the one who has fallen. We need to be praying for them. And then there are a whole lot of other people that maybe they haven't been injured like some people really close to the destruction have, but everybody's been affected in some way. We need to be praying for one another, and especially for those who lead. I say that because going back to Peter, in Luke chapter 22 and in verse 31, in Luke 22, Jesus said to Peter there in verse 31, he said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Peter said, I'm not ever going to. He said, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death. Jesus said, let me tell you, you're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows. And he did. But Jesus said something there that's ominous to me. Satan has asked for you. How many of us has Satan asked the Lord for? I don't know. I don't know how that even works. All I know is what Jesus said. I know it obviously happened. Why Peter? Why Peter? Who was it that got out of the boat? Who was it that seemed to always be in the lead with the disciples? Even in Acts chapter 2, in Acts chapter 10, Peter was that one that just had this natural ability of leadership. And the other disciples seemed to appreciate it. They looked to him. I think that's why. I think that's why you see what happened to David, what happened to Moses, what happened to Abraham, what happened to Peter. Because Satan knows that he can affect one person, or he can affect one person that will affect many other people. We need to be praying for leaders because Satan is especially asking for them. And if you are in a role of leadership, you might say, well, I'm not an elder, I'm not a deacon, I'm not a preacher. Are you a parent? Are you a Bible class teacher? Are you an older brother or sister? Are you someone that other young people look up to? Satan's asking for you. And we need to be praying for all of those who are in these positions of leadership. Because as Peter said, and he would know, in 1 Peter 5 and 8, our adversary, the devil, he roams about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. He knew what he was speaking about. And he is seeking each one of us. Yes, we need to learn these lessons. Have an objective view of one another. You know, when I was talking about the fact that we shouldn't put our faith in men, one of the things I failed to say is I look at Paul and his confronting of Peter in Galatians chapter 2. Paul had an objective view of Peter. He appreciated Peter's leadership, but he also knew that Peter could fall. And he confronted him with his sin. You know, when we begin to put our faith in men, here's one of the things that can happen. We can either become so discouraged because his hero fell that we lose our own faith, or we're unwilling to see the faults in that person because they are our hero, and we won't even consider them. We deny them. That's what leads a person to be in a cult, when they're unwilling to ever see anything wrong in a person. We see in Paul and with the case of Peter that we can't ever do that in our life. We need to see people objectively. It'll help us love them better. It'll help us be a better friend to them. It'll help us rescue them. We need to be praying for everyone, especially for those who lead. Well, I'm sure that there are other lessons we can learn from God's word about what we do and how we cope with it when our heroes fall. But these were some of the things that I had to realize and understand to be able to cope with that in my own life. And I'm thankful that God was there for me, that his revelation, his instruction is there, and it's there for each one of us. I'm sure you've experienced this in one way or another. I hope you'll make application of this. I hope it's been helpful. We're going to take a break for a few minutes before our next hour of worship, but before we do that, would you bow with me in prayer?